Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk back with us once again. Clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And we'll be talking about what you should know before boarding your pet. We'll take a look at things like kennel cough and answer your general pet, cat, dog questions. So I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post your pet photo for sure on our Facebook page. We love that. You can post your questions there as well. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Well, kennel cough on our minds to begin with, and maybe define that. What is kennel cough?
Well, it's actually, if you want the real true medical name, it's canine infectious tracheobronchitis, which means that it's inflammation of the big airways, and there are a whole host of things that can cause it. And I think the number one myth is that your dog has to be kenneled to get it. You don't have to get it from a kennel. You just have to get it, be in contact with other dogs, either directly or indirectly, because some of these bugs are even transmitted on objects and things as well. So
kennel cough is a bad name in a way, then.
Yeah, it really is. And although we typically see it in dogs that go to dog shows and dog parks and kennels, it can just be, hey, you picked it up because you took your dog to a family gathering where there were other dogs. And there are dogs that have had kennel cough in the past, and they may still be shedding it. In fact, one of the causes, Bordetella, which is like our whooping cough that people get, dogs, once they're even clear of all their symptoms, can shed it for 2 to 3 months, and it's in their saliva and droplets like that. And so you've got your dog wrestling and playing with another dog, they could very easily pick it up. So what I want people to be thinking about is, before you start taking your dog, and this really is year round, but it tends to be worse in the winter, because when we've got dogs confined into closed spaces, kind of like people in the winter, when it's really cold out and airways are a little bit more irritated and the air's a little drier and the airways just don't have the same moisture level, we see more cases of kennel cough. And thinking ahead and making sure that your dog is up to date on the things that we can vaccinate for. There are a lot of causes of kennel cough besides your typical ones that we vaccinate for and that we don't have vaccines for. So it's one of those things where it sometimes is pet owner beware if you have to take your pet someplace. One thing that I always ask owners to do is, if your dog does have a cough and is you want to get them in to have them checked out by your veterinarian, is don't take them into the clinic. Leave your pet in the car. And sometimes we will even triage these patients out in the parking lot, because just that few minutes of waiting time in the waiting room,
hacking and coughing,
you could infect everybody. So, yeah. And, some of these respond to antibiotics. Others, it's just tincture of time, rest, isolation. But if you're going to be boarding your dog, make sure that they are up to date on Bordetella vaccine, adenovirus vaccine, which is often included with the Bordetella that's given nasally, parainfluenza, which is not influenza, it's a totally different bug, and the two influenza bugs that are now out there for dogs, the H3N2 and the H3N8. The kennel cough vaccine you can get by with, often with the nasal form, a single dose and you're done. And within 2-3 days, you've got good protection. The influenza vaccine, though, requires 2 doses, a minimum of 2 weeks apart, and then 2 weeks after that, you've got some protection. So if you're thinking of getting your dog into the kennel over the holidays, you're already kind of missed the mark.
Almost,
and many kennels are requiring dogs to be vaccinated for influenza now.
So lots of things to think about when it comes to kennel. Anything else in terms of kennel, getting your dog ready, or what should you think about?
I like to have owners bring their own food so that we don't have a major diet change. We see a lot of kennels are now requiring dogs to have a negative fecal for intestinal parasites. And we have had, just even last week with Thanksgiving week, had people not expecting their dog to have intestinal parasites drop off a stool sample, and guess what? It's positive for something. And then they're scrambling because they can't board their dog because we can't get it treated in time to be able to have a negative fecal. So really plan ahead and check with the kennel to make sure that, you know, what they require, so that you're not leaving things to the last minute, because there's a lot of dogs walking around with intestinal parasites that kennels don't want to see get their kennel inoculated with the dog boarding there.
You know what? Connie in Portage has a question that kind of goes along with what you're just talking about. Connie, hi. Thanks for calling. What is on your mind?
Hi. Well, I have a little corgi that's a diabetic, and he needs to have insulin twice a day. And we were invited to go to Illinois and for Christmas Eve. And so I don't know how to do this, and I can't find a veterinary clinic that's going to be open to give him, to board him to give the insulin. Mm-hmm. And because he'd have to stay, they said, till Monday. And we just didn't want to leave him that long. And plus, he misses his English bulldog mother.
So
I don't know what... I want to know if missing one dose of insulin, what it would do to him.
I would be a little worried. I mean, it's probably not going to do a whole lot. But I think that having someone, when you've got a pet with a serious medical condition like diabetes, I would look at maybe getting a in-house pet sitter. In the Madison area, we have many, many pet sitters that have like veterinary technician training and background to be able to administer medications like this. And it's a good
idea.
Believe it or not, many of them, that's their job,
really?
And they will work and do that. But start planning now, because, you know, they may be backed up. But that would be something to consider doing. Yes, unfortunately, a diabetic dog going into a kennel, I really worry about them staying in a kennel situation, because if they don't eat, or if the insulin, I mean, many kennels have people on staff that are trained to be able to give injections. But, you know, you really need to have, you know, someone there that is able to make sure that they're eating. And it can be stressful, and they may not. So at-home care, I think, would be the best thing for your dog.
You know, I wonder if your vet would have recommendations of pet sitters in the area. Some vets mm-hmm. have that, don't they?
Definitely. There's, we at the vet school even have many technicians that do this kind of on the side as their own little private business. They'll go in and give fluids to cats and monitor blood pressure, because when you bring a pet into the vet clinic, their blood pressure goes up, and then we don't know what it is. You know, if is it really elevated? And so they actually go to the people's homes for a fee, obviously, to be able to get some of these things done. So yes, talk to your vet first. That would be your first thing that you would do, and then, you know, before you go to just the yellow pages or whatever and look up something.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Connie. Good luck. Let us know how that turns out. Yeah, we'd like to know that. Bill in the town of Barnes, one of my old stomping grounds. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Good morning. I have two golden retrievers, both of the English cream variety, if that matters in the diagnosis here. And as puppies, and to a lesser degree, but still as adults, they have almost a fetish for birch bark.
Mm-hmm.
That they want to tear into it, and they do eat it. I mean, they shred it up little pieces, but I've watched them, and I'm pretty sure they're actually eating it. I don't see it, the poop at the end of the process, but it sure looks like they're eating it.
Yeah.
What are they after, and should I be concerned?
And,
you know, we see dogs developing these kind of weird habits of things that they like to do. And it's kind of like, I mean, I'm going to use a human example. You know, when you get sunburned, you know, how gratifying it is to peel the skin off, you know, and things like that. Well, maybe that's all it is that it's kind of a fun game for them to pull and have something give way. It's probably just because of the nature of the bark, not going to be a problem for them. Other types, like really like the heavy duty bark and things, could cause more problems just because it's chunkier and could splinter. But with the birch bark, it probably wouldn't be an issue. I'd be more concerned about the health of the trees. At dog level, pulling off the bark could, you know, damage the trees. So hopefully they're just doing this to downed wood. But yeah, I don't look at it as a problem, especially if the trees haven't been treated with any pesticides or anything like that. It really shouldn't be a problem for them.
There you go.
Good deal. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot. As long as we're talking about dogs chewing on things, there's another report out on some bones.
Yeah. Many people like to give their pets treats over the holidays. And, you know, as veterinarians, we say, you know, don't give your dogs bones. But there are bones that you can get that are treat bones. These are bones available at pet stores and grocery stores that have usually been smoked or dried. They may consist of a slice of a bone or a rib bone or something. And there's been multiple reports of dogs running into troubles with these just because they're packaged and wrapped in cellophane and available for sale doesn't mean that they're safe. And so they tend to be, they splinter very easily. And they, you know, dogs will chew on them because they're pretty tasty because of the smoke and stuff that's been added to them. But just really beware if your dog gets one of these as a gift or you're thinking about buying them, they can be problematic for the dog, not only with breaking teeth because of how hard they are, like any bone, but even these bones that typically don't splinter because of the way they're processed, they do splinter and they can swallow these bits and run into all kinds of troubles with their intestinal tract and esophagus and so on. So be careful.
Be careful. Let's go to Bobby in Milwaukee next. Hi, Bobby.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to ask a question. This is Bobby from Milwaukee. I wanted to ask a question about calicoes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Was going on a trip, so I had him vaccinated for calicoes. They had the one in the nasal.
Mm-hmm.
So I had never heard of calicoes before, and he didn't have calicoes. So when he got that vaccination, he coughed, but she said that would stop.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did go on the trip, I took him to the kennel. When I came back, they had his collar on him real loose. And when I got home, he was just coughing and coughing. He was just couldn't breathe. He was having a lot of problems. So I took him back to the vet, and they gave him some pills, and that seemed to help.
Okay.
So he's not doing all that coughing anymore, but once in a while he'll do it, but wasn't a great while.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
As a whole, he don't. So now I'm scared to take him to the border or to the groomer. So I want to know, is it a possibility, if he get the vaccination again, will he get the calicoes?
Well, thank you for bringing this up. One of the very uncommon reactions that we see with the intranasal vaccine is a vaccine-induced cough. It's very uncommon, and it usually starts about 2 to 10 days after being vaccinated, which is why I like to have people vaccinate their pets well before they're going into the kennel, because some kennels will not accept them if they're coughing. And how can you tell? Is this something infectious, or is this a result of an adverse vaccine reaction? But it sounds like your dog was very ill. Dogs that develop the cough associated with the vaccine, or it's just more of a nuisance thing, and they're not sick, they're still getting around fine, but the fact that your dog was so down and out and lethargic, I think they probably really had kennel cough. And this is the big issue, is that there are so many causes for kennel cough, and we do not have vaccines to treat all of them. Your dog may have already picked it up and been incubating it prior to vaccinating, or if you had your dog vaccinated and then taken right to the kennel, the vaccine may not have had enough time to have the dog's body develop immunity to it. So there's a lot of reasons for this, but I'd be looking at where you're boarding your dog, making sure that they have good ventilation, that there is no nose-to-nose contact with other dogs, so solid barriers between between the dogs. That's not going to stop droplets and things from spreading, but that would be, you know, something I would personally be looking at, that they are using disinfectants, that they're not sharing water bowls or toys or anything like that, because that is, again, one of those things that could transmit food bowls and things if they're not washed thoroughly. That can be a way that dogs can get kennel cough as well. So, you know,
What about the groomer? Bobby was talking about...
Well, and grooming is one of those places where they are boarding for the day. Many times you have to drop your dog off and they're there for several hours with lots of other dogs. And remember, a dog can be healthy and still be shedding kennel cough. And so the majority of dogs that get kennel cough, it's a nuisance thing. They cough, they keep you awake at night. And, you know, we sometimes will treat them with antibiotics if we think that there's a good chance that it's a bacterial infection like Bordetella or Mycoplasma, but these viruses that cause it won't respond to antibiotics. We'll sometimes put them on cough suppressants. The dogs that really get hit hard with getting canine infectious tracheobronchitis, kennel cough, are usually the young dogs under 6 months of age, elderly dogs, or dogs like the breed I have, the push-face dogs like bulldogs and pugs and so on. They already have trouble breathing, and you throw on top of that a little bit of a respiratory infection, and they can really get hit hard too. So, those are dogs that really need to be kept up on their vaccines and be looking at lifestyle things. Perhaps having a mobile groomer come to your home may be one of the ways of getting your dog groomed without the risk of having exposure to lots of other dogs if you're afraid to take them to the groomer.
Yeah, that's a way.
My dog was 6 years old when he got it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, typical middle-aged dogs like that usually don't get that sick. But I worry about things like, you know, was this one of the influenza bugs that's kind of a newer thing that we're seeing where dogs can really become ill with it? And if you had just vaccinated your dog with the nasal vaccine, that wasn't covered. And so that's the dilemma, is that there are bugs out there that we do not have vaccines for. And you have to just make sure that you're boarding them at a reputable kennel, that your dog is in really good health if they're going to be going into the kennel situation. And so do your homework ahead of time and check these kennels out, and just don't make the assumption that, you know, everything's going to be great when they're there. I have been in some kennels that I am just amazed that they stay in business. I always recommend visiting a kennel and making sure. There are tons of them out there that are absolutely spotless and, you know, good hygiene, but there are some that
aren't so hot.
What you pay for.
Well,
yeah.
Just to follow up, once you give a shot, let's say an injection,
uh-huh,
how long is that good for the specific thing that it was injected
for? So influenza, it takes, like I said, two injections, to a minimum of 2 weeks apart, and that's usually good for a year, after they've gone through the series. The Bordetella vaccine, typically we do that, especially if you're using like the nasal vaccine, a single dose for the majority of dogs is good for a year. But if they're going to be in a really high risk situation, such as a dog that's going to the kennel a lot, going to dog shows a lot, some veterinarians advocate doing it more often, maybe even as much as every 6 months. Typically a year is fine.
Okay. Bobby, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Louisa DeVogel, our on-air producer today, here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow at 11, we'll take a look at urban wildlife gardens and why they matter, not just to let us enjoy it, but for the larger community as well. Right now, though, we're taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. All our lines are filled, and you can email us, by the way, at ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, and we certainly are hoping you post some of your pet photos. We love those. And keep trying on the phones. It's 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Marty in Douglas County next. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Dr. Sandy, I just want to know what you think of this. I have a friend who lives in New Mexico. She has a cat who's been diagnosed with an exquisitely rare form of skin cancer. She's had a lesion on her back for quite a while. The fur is totally gone. There's nothing her vet can do for this. It's such a rare thing. Because it's New Mexico where they have medical marijuana, my friend got some, she thought it was just hemp oil. It wasn't even something you need a prescription or, you know, thing for. Took the oil, put it on this lesion. It, in 6 days, the thing has healed up. Almost, very significantly, and the fur is growing back.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is one of these topics that in the veterinary world, we really know very little about use of CBD oils and that type of thing. You know, in states where THC is legalized, there are many people that are thinking, well, let's use it in our dogs. But we have no research as to what dose to use, how to administer it, what it's helpful for. So I don't know what kind of skin cancer the cat had. I would love to have known the biopsy report to make sure that that really was what was going on, because you know anytime you have biopsies done, depending on who reads it, sometimes getting a second opinion on a biopsy if it's something really bizarre to find out really is that truly what it was. But I'm glad the cat's better. There is a study. There are you know studies going on right now. I know. I think Colorado State Vet School now has a study looking at use of CBD oil in pets, but. It's not one of those things that as veterinarians we can really be advocating because we just don't know anything about it. So if an owner does it on their own, that's their prerogative, but it's probably not going to be endorsed by a veterinarian.
Oh, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Marty. Bill in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We have a Sheltie that's going to be 9 years old in December, and we've had him for going on 7 years. He's been healthy up to now, but about 12 to 18 months ago, he had a melanoma in his mouth that we had removed. And for the last 3 months or so, he's been dealing with a tumor on the back of his neck, and it has grown to about the size of a grape. I just came back from the vet this morning to get his kennel cough shot, and she looked at it again. She has been aspirating it, and she says her tests show that it is a non-malignant basal cell cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And she said if we were to remove it, we'd have to put him out, and I'm not real keen on that. So she suggests watching it. If it gets bigger and breaks, then bring it back in or aspirate it once in a while. And I'm wondering if the diagnosis isn't that it bothers me more than it bothers him.
Yeah, and sometimes it's true. I mean, the fact that it's on the neck, we have to also look at, even with like insignificant like skin tags and things, if they're in the area where a collar may rub on it and irritate it, it may be bothersome for the dog. And so, you know, when we're dealing with something like this, yes, basal cell tumors tend to be rather like low grade, very benign type tumors. Often it is cosmetic. They can sometimes get to be, you know, bigger, and which would mean, you know, a more invasive surgery to be able to get them removed. What I'm most concerned about is the fact that your dog had an oral melanoma. I know you just brought that up in passing, but oral melanomas in dogs are, it's one of the worst types of cancer we can deal with. They tend to be very malignant, and I'd be, you know, making sure that your dog is being followed extremely closely for, you know, the next, you know, for the rest of his life with having that melanoma removed. I'm glad that your dog is doing well, but that would be something that would have me a little concerned and be wanting to watch that. So
we've had to check that when he's been in for his regular shots. We didn't do that today because the prime focus was on the thing on his neck. It's not in an area where it interferes with his collar, so that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But next time I take him in, I'll have her look at that mouth again.
Yeah,
for sure.
And sometimes we take chest X-rays, looking at regional lymph nodes and making sure that those are palpated very carefully. And if there's anything that looks like a little bit bigger on one side than the other, getting lymph node aspirates done. Those would be all things that you'd want to be looking into.
When the melanoma was removed, she had talked about starting a very extensive. Chemotherapy, but then we talked again, and she went back to the lab that evaluated the pathology, And she said they determined that she had gotten it all out.
Good, good.
Fairly early. My wife notices all these little things very well, better than I.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's one of the things that when you take biopsies, we always look at the margins to make sure that we don't have things extending past the margins. And so it sounds like your vet is right on top of everything. And, you know, if your dog has to be anesthetized or heavily sedated for something, you could probably even remove this with local anesthetic under heavy sedation if you're uncomfortable with anesthesia. I'm just saying that off the top of my head because I don't know. I'm not looking at your dog right now. But a lot of times we can do these minor surgeries as long as the dog is really quiet and we've got enough local in there to be able to block the area.
Okay, so it's right. This is more of a problem for me than it is for the dog, but we keep watching it.
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's turn to Don in Plover next. Don, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'd like to just kind of make a little, when you were talking about kennel cough, I've got English setters, and I've had them for quite some time. And I've also had blastomycosis. And actually, I have one dog right now that I'm treating for it. And I think it starts out similar to a kennel cough.
It does, yes.
And the only thing is the dog I have now, he's 6 years old. He started out with a lesion on the side of his shoulder. And I got very suspicious of it right away and went to the vet, and they did a urine sample and sent it in, which took some time, and then I got more concerned because this lesion didn't go away, so I started treating him for it right away. And I've been into it for about a month now, and he did go through a cough for a while, and now he seems to be doing quite well. But I guess my main point to bring up is if your dog does come up with a kennel cough or something that doesn't seem right, take them into the vet right away.
Right.
This blastomycosis, people don't realize how serious this is.
Oh, it is very serious, especially for dogs living in Wisconsin. And I, Dawn, thank you very much for bringing this up. Coughing is just one of those symptoms of many different diseases, everything from heart disease to parasitic diseases, lungworm, heartworm, so on, to infectious problems like you were talking about, fungal infections, blastomycosis. So, you know, we see dogs coughing that have primary lung tumors, metastatic disease. And so when we have a dog that's coughing, don't just make that assumption that, hey, my dog was just at a kennel, it's got kennel cough. They should be checked out. But with that said, when you call to make the appointment, you know, just say, I'll leave my dog in the car until we can get them in without exposure to other dogs. And so in our clinic, we'll triage them out in the parking lot, kind of depending on the weather, or bring them in a side door into an exam room that then can be quarantined off and disinfected totally before another pet gets put in there. So we often, until we prove otherwise, we'll treat these animals as if they're contagious, but we do look for all those things. So when we're doing our physical exam and our x-rays and so on, all those things are going through our mind. And I'm so glad that you're getting your dog the treatment that it needs for the blasto, because it is a disease that can be fatal. And it's something that once you get that diagnosis, get started on treatment.
Good points. Thank you, Don, very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Shoot us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And speaking of the page, lots of really cool photos of dogs. Oh, look at that one.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
A white dog with a, what would you call that hat?
I'm not sure, but it's very cute little dog. My dogs, if I put clothes on them of any sort, would not want to, you know, sit still with that. But they're running through the water.
Bridget running through the water. Look at this.
Oh, my goodness.
From Bridget.
Yep.
A foster pups, she says.
Oh, my goodness.
Look at them. They're great. Wonderful photos. Go to our Facebook page and take a look if you haven't already, and post your own. Ann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hello. See, I have a multiple cat household, and there are days when things get kind of tense. And I'm wondering, is there such a thing as a mild sedative? And I'm not talking something to give every day just when tensions get high. I don't want a tranquilizer. I don't want Prozac, fluoxetine, whatever that is. But I'm just wondering if there's something that you could give them to kind of mellow things out for a while.
Yeah, one is a closed door between cats, because if you do have issues where they are upset with each other, isolation is sometimes your best key. Trying feel away or the facial pheromones that we use for cats, plugging that in, using that comes in collars and so on, that might be something that you can get over the counter.
Yeah, I've done it. That does not work.
Okay.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, and then you know when it comes to medications, there are over the counter products that usually contain like milk proteins and other very mild calmatives. There's one that's called Composure. There's another one called Soliquin that's licensed for cats and labeled for cats. So you can get them like online, through some of the shopping online places. A lot of pet stores carry them as well. So that would be something that you could use that have kind of a herbal basis as well as, some other things added in there. And then we start looking at prescription medications. And some of the drugs that you brought up, like fluoxetine, Prozac, that has an induction phase. So you need to have them on it daily to have a benefit. So you're looking at, 4 to 6 weeks before you can start saying whether it's working or not or helping. Often what we will do, especially for cats that get really stressed with coming into the clinic, is we will pre-treat them with a drug that is a human medication used for neuropathic pain, but it does have some nice kind of anti-anxiety sedation effects. And that's called gabapentin. You would have to get this via prescription from your veterinarian. But I always, the big question is, what's causing the tension between the cats, and what can we do to eliminate some of that, whether it's expanding their territory vertically with more cat trees, multiple litter boxes, multiple feeding stations, areas that one cat can get into that the other cat can't, such as a microchip reading pet door that's installed into a room so only one cat can get into that room and have their own private space. So it may come down to more, what can I do environmentally to make my cats get along better?
All of the above.
You know what? There are just some cats that just do not get along, and people have to live in a house divided just for the cat's sanity and their own sanity.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you so much for calling, and appreciate it. Linda in Brookfield, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Sandy, so far we have been able to duck the whole boarding issue, combination of family members moving in. And one time I even took him back to his breeder, and that meant 10 hours in the car. The thing that worries me the most about boarding any animal is that even, I've toured these places and the suites are beautiful. There are even TVs in the little doggy suites. But at night, they're left alone. There's no human in the building. Mm-hmm. And I just worry about, a dog getting sick or a fire breaking out. Are there boarding facilities that are manned 24 hours a day?
Yes. And I know that there is one in the Madison area that does that. In fact, they even, if for an extra fee, will have a human sleep over with your dog and stay in the suite with them. And they call those sleepovers. So, so there are kennels that have people there.
I would think there'd be one in the Brookfield area.
I would assume that there would be, but it may just take some searching and some visiting just to be able to see, what's there. I mean, obviously, places like that, you're going to be probably paying a little bit extra to have people overnight. But I know that there are, some vet clinics that have like nighttime technician staff that are there that stay overnight too. But I look at like boarding at a vet clinic kind of like, going on vacation and staying at the hospital. It's kind of like, I don't know if I'd really want to do that unless it's a separate facility from the actual clinic facility where sick patients are housed.
Right. Well, so far I haven't found one in the area, but you've given me hope, so I'm going to keep trying to find one.
Okay,
excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks, Linda. Appreciate the call. And Larry in Coloma, it's your turn now. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. I got a question, doctor. I have an 11 or 12-year-old beagle. It was a rescue beagle. A year and a half ago, came down with an autoimmune deficiency, blood disorder. Very serious. We kind of got that under control with medication, steroids, and so on. But she's had this nasal discharge and sneezing. She does a lot of sneezing, and there's been discharge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my vet has told me that they've done tests on it. The discharge is not contagious or anything like that. It's and they said that it's probably something she's going to have to live with for the rest of her life. Other than having to watch this, it doesn't seem to affect her. Now we have put her on some amoxicillin at times when it's gotten real bad, and that seems to get it to let up, but it doesn't go away completely.
Yeah, yeah. You know, whenever we have a dog with chronic nasal issues like this, we're often looking at, just collecting the discharge that is visible at the outside of the nose often doesn't give us any answers because it may be contaminated with bacteria and things that are, just growing naturally in that area. So, if you really want to get answers, you may be looking at going through what I affectionately call the nasal extravaganza, which is under anesthesia, getting either CT or MRI done of your dog's skull. Radiographs, x-rays may or may not be helpful, but a CT scan is going to give you much better answers. But when we're dealing with a senior dog, I worry about things like nasal tumors, bad teeth that are abscessed that have now had the root abscess blow up into the nasal passage. And so we'd be looking for things like that. And then after the CT scan, doing rhinoscopy, where you actually go up and have a look to see what's going on. Obviously, this is all done under anesthesia. Sometimes we'll do some therapeutic nasal flushing, and it will, flush and collect the material and have a look at that. Sometimes before we even jump to doing that, there is a mite that lives in the nose. That's called the nasal mite. We are often very surprised when we, have not already treated for this and we've got the dog under anesthesia and we look up the nose and there's these little mites crawling around. But the symptoms for that is like chronic nasal discharge and sneezing. So talk to your veterinarian about potentially, since this is something that's contagious dog to dog, having your dog treated for nasal mites before you start jumping into anything else, because that can be a chronic problem and it is actually pretty easy to treat.
Well, we did have her down at UW a year ago and did all the CT scans. She actually had x-rays, and there were some teeth that were broken and were removed and such, so I would assume that much of your it would have shown up something at that time.
So it sounds like you're doing everything, but it may be time to, go back and either, re-look at some of those lab results and say, is there anything that we missed? And just don't assume that there's nothing that can be done. Things like saline nasal drops, the nasal like decongestants and things that can be used sometimes give the dog relief, but without actually curing them. So there may be things like that can be done as well.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. We're going to go to our emails next. And Betty emailed to say she has her 8-year-old Bichon and her 10-year-old Schnoodle with a cough they've had for 3 months. They each cough once a day at various times. Vet says it sounds like kennel cough. Both dogs have had x-rays and blood work. and they were normal. Both have been on two rounds of antibiotics, doxycycline and Clavamax, and it didn't help. They both just started on prednisone. That doesn't know the cause.
Yeah, and this just gets down to the fact that, you know, we've got two dogs in the same household that are coughing. And that's that, but it's just once a day. And a cough is a normal response to clear irritants from the airway. So is there something in the home that may be triggering this? Did someone take up smoking? Have you, you know, added in, you know, new carpet cleaners or something that may be leaving a residue behind that the dog is inhaling? You know, they're both small dogs. Do they have something like an issue with a collapsing trachea? I've seen dogs that are obese with a very, you know, a fragile trachea. Instead of having those good rings, they're softer. The cartilage is softer, and just that added extra weight can trigger a dog to cough as well. But we do see things like chronic bronchitis, which is what I assume that the veterinarian is putting them on steroids for, that can just happen sometimes after they've been infected with something. So, again, without seeing the X-rays, I don't know what's there, but there are, you know, I'm glad that your veterinarian is at least looking and trying and not just saying, hey, it's kennel cough, that there are other things that could be causing your dogs to cough. But look into the household, because two in the same household, I really start worrying about environmental things.
Ann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting, Ann. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess there was an Ann ahead of me, so I wasn't sure if it was the Ann one or two. My sister's dog is going to be coming in January to visit for a couple of weeks. And as far as I know, she's healthy, but our dog is 9, so I want to be sure that we do what we need to do. If the dog has not had a cough, are we okay with the kennel cough issue?
Yeah, I mean, you can't live in a world like keep your dog in a bubble. I mean, we don't live that way. And yes, periodically we're going to pick up a respiratory infection and have to deal with the consequences. But, you know, if the dog has normal stool, hasn't been coughing, has been to the vet, been checked, you know, is parasite free, doesn't have fleas, doesn't have intestinal parasites, everything should be fine if they've been checked out. It's you know, the problems I have are, you know, your dog's romping with unknown dogs, going to the dog park and not being sure, is this dog vaccinated? Have they been coughing 2 weeks ago, but they're still shedding the virus or the bacteria, because they can be absolutely normal and still shedding it. So you'll be able to know, has this puppy been ill in the previous few weeks? If it hasn't, most likely everything's going to be fine. So don't get too worried about it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Anne, for calling. Diane and Harrison, it's your turn. Hi, Diane.
Yes, hi. Hi, Doc. Good to hear your voice again. Okay, well, I just have some positivity to add. First of all, with this being a season of giving, which it should be all year, this is a suggestion. I have a dear aunt that just lost her husband, and she would love so much to have a dog, but she's on oxygen, and she's special needs. But to remind people that instead of getting grandma another unnecessary sweater, or the neighbor that needs help, to lend ourselves to the animals in their life. Like I say, my aunt would love to have a dog, but she can't take it out. And neighbors that maybe are incapacitated, where you say, hey, you know what, let me take your dog out for a year, you know, and give a credit to their veterinarians, so they have, you know, their vaccinations are covered, or accompany grandma or whatever to the vet with the dog, or say, let me take the dog in for you, just to make life a little bit easier for people. But and also to donate to the shelters in the name of somebody that you love, because we all have too much stuff, but shelters are there all year long.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Such good suggestions this time of the year. And, you know, I even though your relative is on oxygen, that doesn't mean that they can't have a pet. It may mean that it would need to be something like a cat. But if
dogs,
they're...
She would like to have like a little miniature schnauzer. But her problem is walking getting the dog outside to go to the bathroom because she has to carry her oxygen tank.
Yeah.
And it just is too hard.
She can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's, you know, but maybe this would be the type of thing where having people come and let them, you know, bring their dogs and visit and let her have kind of a dog for the day where you're visiting and giving that kind of attention. And she may just, that might be enough to just kind of get her through and make her day.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
but thank you for all those suggestions.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Diane, for calling. Appreciate it. Elizabeth and Mequon, it's your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. We have a kitten that's around 19, 20 weeks old. And 3 weeks ago, we just had gotten him, and we had a little mouse toy that we'd had with other cats, never had a problem. We noticed soon that the sort of a 2.5-inch sort of a braided plastic-like tail was gone. And we never found it anywhere in the house. And we did look through his stools most of the time, never found anything. He seems completely normal. But we're wondering if we should do anything, if there's anything we should see the vet.
No. I mean, at this point, I would say it's been 3 weeks. If it was going to cause an obstruction, you'd be seeing vomiting, diarrhea, you know, abdominal discomfort. It most likely passed, and you just didn't find it. You know, this always reminds me of there's a story that I had a veterinary colleague who did exotics work, and he worked down in the Florida area. And sometimes when you do kind of some wildlife things, you have to do like a blow dart to sedate your patient. And his little son went into his kit and pulled out a straw type thing and grabbed a needle and saw dad doing the blow dart, but instead of blowing, sucked in and swallowed the needle. And so they took the child to the hospital, and the child ended up getting x-rayed, and then sure enough, it was there. They're just like, feed him a bulky diet. Here's a hood for the toilet. You know, just watch him. If he develops any symptoms, we'll deal with it, but it may just work its way out. And so that's what they did. And after, you know, a couple of days of feeding a lot of bulky food to the kid, and of course dad being the veterinarian wasn't involved with checking the poop, but mom was, she, you know, the kid's like, mom, I went again. And so she took her time going into the bathroom, and by the time she got there, their black lab was walking out, and the little hood in the toilet was clean. And they x-rayed the dog, and guess where the needle was? In the dog. So so it's amazing. Yeah. You know, so I think it's been this length of time, it probably isn't going to be a problem, but it just goes to show you, just because a toy is safe with one pet doesn't mean it's going to be safe with another one. Anytime you introduce something new, make sure that you're there observing and don't leave the pet alone with it, because parts do go missing.
Good advice.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And there's one story that you told me. Here we are in the Christmas season, and it in a way, it almost sounds funny, but it really is not funny at all. And that involves cutting down a Christmas tree.
Right. And the owners took their small dog with them. And I don't know how big this tree was, but it fell on the dog and killed the dog. So
that's terrible.
Yes. So dogs on leashes, when they're outside, you know, they should be, if you know, can't control the dog, control the environment, which means putting them on a leash. And it's wonderful to include them in family events like this, but safety first. And I know, doesn't that sound, it was
horrible.
A horrible thing to have happen, but you know, stranger things have happened too. So
Leslie and Rhinelander, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. Bear with me, I'm coming off of bronchitis. I want to follow up, if I might, with you with the blastomycosis, you know, and perhaps you can explain maybe more in depth to your audience. And the reason I'm bringing this up is for several reasons. One is how deadly it is, and then it can stay. This is for both humans and dogs. Mm-hmm. It can stay in your system for 3 to 5 months before it actually shows. And for humans, they tend to misdiagnose as pneumonia. I just lost one of my greyhounds October 7th, which took me totally by surprise because I didn't know that it was in and how horrific this can be, but in the area. And my one-year-old greyhound was just tested and has it and is on the medicine. but I'm curious. I think when I'm talking with people, they either know nothing about it, or the kind of is that because it's a fungi and it's a spore, that it's, oh, well, this is just what we have to live with. However, and I want to know why the state of Minnesota, the vet, for humans, they have to report it to the Center for Disease Control if you have any kind of tick disease or blastomycosis. But in the state of Wisconsin, the vets do not have to report it. And mm-hmm. in Minnesota, they do. And I'm wondering, anything going towards that direction? Because they're starting to see a significant increase in blastomycosis. They had 6 cases in 1 month for dogs, and they're starting to also see it in humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's especially in the north.
Yeah.
And you and I have both had it.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where it's a soil-borne fungus. The pets or the humans themselves are not contagious to other people or other pets, but it is in the soil. So it's a lot of times it's lifestyle dependent. You know, dogs that have their nose to the ground and are inhaling these spores are going to be more at risk than the little pampered pooch that rarely ever touches the ground. So we see it a lot in hunting dogs and it's, you know, just because they're out in the field and have a greater chance of being able to be exposed to it. I'm wondering if we're actually seeing more of it, or just being better at diagnosing it. Because it is one of those things that in the past, it wasn't the easiest thing to diagnose, but now we have a urine blasto test that we can do that is very accurate. And it's, you know, it's something that you know, we can just run when we're looking, thinking that if blasto is at all on the radar, to be able to get that off the table. So, yeah, thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah, and we can talk a little more about it. We need to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We have, when we broke for news, Leslie and Rhinelander had talked about blastomycosis. You described it and talked a bit about it. But she also wondered if the state of Wisconsin would are there any laws in effect, or will there be laws in effect regarding reporting of blasto?
Yeah, and in the veterinary world, it is not a reportable disease. So I really don't know what's happening in the human world, and it would be very nice to be able to track kind of hot spots where this disease actually shows up, and having that information would be really helpful for people that live in those areas, or that have, they themselves are sick or their pet is sick, to be able to be a little more, like, you know, in tune to the fact that that may be a possibility. So I don't know, but maybe somebody in the public health field would be able to call and let us know what's happening.
Yeah, if there's anything going on, or in Leslie's case, she might be contacting her own representative and asking
about it. Yeah,
makes good sense. And thanks again, Leslie, for that call. Laura in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Laura, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We rescued 2 kittens in August from the Humane Society. They're little brothers. But there was a lot of respiratory infection at the Humane Society at the time. And one of them had, a lot of eye drainage, so we brought them home. One, we had to put eye drops in the eye that was affected, and it was kind of swollen, too. After about a week, though, the other one started to get eye drainage as well. So we brought them into the vet, and they were put on oral antibiotics, which seemed to help it. But off and on, ever since then, they've had, like, clear eye drainage. But now, they're 6 months old now, mm-hmm. Or almost 6 months, and they can daily have eye drainage. And it's clear, and I just wipe their eye away with a damp cloth.
Are they squinting? Are they squinting or rubbing at their eyes, acting like their eyes are uncomfortable?
No.
No.
They don't.
Okay. So
one maybe sometimes has a little boogers.
Okay. Yeah. Most of the respiratory infections that we see in cats are viral. And one of the most common ones is a herpes virus called rhinotracheitis. And once a cat gets exposed, they have it for life. And it doesn't mean that they may be symptomatic for life, but they may have, whenever they're stressed or whatever, a recurrence of the infection, just like herpes is in with people. So the fact that their eyes still draining a little bit of clear discharge, it may be that the tear ducts, if they were severely affected, there may be enough scarring and things that it's just causing the tears to overflow. So that would be something to be looking into if they are anesthetized or heavily sedated, to actually see if the tear ducts are patent. Sometimes we'll see animals, depending on the conformation of their face. So obviously cats that have more of a push face, like Burmese and Persians and so on, that have the bulgier eyes, are going to have more tearing, and it's almost normal for them to have ocular discharge just because of the way they're built. So I'm not sure if these kittens have that facial conformation that would make that kind of a normal thing for them. One thing that you could try is, if we're having kind of recurrences of eye infections, kind of respiratory stuff, is sometimes we'll put these cats on a amino acid supplement called lysine. Lysine is available in like chewable forms and powders and gels. You don't need a prescription for it. You can buy it online over the counter. That's made specifically for cats with the correct dose on it. It helps prevent viral, it kind of slows down viral replication. So that would be something I think it wouldn't hurt. And if it's a treat that you're giving them, they'll probably love it and think, wow, I'm getting something really special. But little do they know that it's good for them and it's medicine. Yeah.
There you go.
So do I get that lysine from, like, the vet's office or PetSmart?
You can go to Amazon. You can go to Chewy.com. You can go to Foster and Smith. You can go any of like those the online pet supply places will have it. There's one brand that is actually lysine spelt backwards, Enacil. Okay, so that's very easy to remember. Just spell lysine backwards, and that happens to be one brand that
would the local pet stores have them too?
They probably do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Mary in Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. I wasn't even planning on calling today, but I heard a couple other callers. After doctoring for a year with our 14-year-old cat that we had as a stray, he was getting crusty skin lesions. We were referred to a specialist, and it was determined he had Bowen's disease, which is, we're told, very rare in cats. They did a biopsy on three of the lesions, and one had a basal cell. Of course, they kind of cluster the head and the neck. He is looking much better now, but we're still at a standstill. I don't know whether to do surgery or not. I'm told they will come back. I'm feeling just kind of overwhelmed with all the information and trying to sort through it.
Yeah, I actually don't know what Bowen's disease is, and I'm very quickly going to my iPad here and trying to look it up. But
okay.
I think this would be something that I'm glad that biopsies have been done. I think that sometimes, owners are a little hesitant to send in tissue samples and things to be able to get answers and to have some answers like this. But I'm sorry, I really don't know enough about the disease to be able to talk to you about it intelligently, but maybe after a break or something, I can spend a minute on my online or bring it up next month when I'm back again, and we can talk about it then.
Okay, very good. He, like I said, he was a stray, and he does have an autoimmune issue that we've been treating, but, being elderly now, this did crop up. So I always listen, so any information that you have would be greatly appreciated.
Perfect. You can always email me at the vet school as well.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're Thanks welcome. Very much for calling. And while you may be looking, I've got something on Facebook. We know we had a caller earlier from Brookfield who was wondering about boarding, and she hadn't had good luck. And so Richard sent us a note on Facebook, and we've got a link to it right now. It's called river.com book dog boarding, and you connect with five-star staffers and dog walkers nearby, and that's in the Brookfield area. So if that earlier caller from Brookfield is still looking around, why not go to rover.com?
Perfect. And I didn't know that even existed. So that's going to be something that I will refer to when people ask me questions about boarding facilities.
Let's go to Iowa City next and talk with Sam. Sam, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. I had a question. I took my dog in for some... his ears were kind of crusting, and at the tips it seemed like there were little, almost little kind of chunks missing and trying to regrow and looking very raw. And they had mentioned the possibility of vasculitis.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really tell me a treatment or if there's anything I could do for it.
Yeah, we do see, because the blood vessels going out to the edge of the ear are very tiny, anything that can cause inflammation of those blood vessels or having a clotting abnormality or something can sometimes cause those ear margin abnormalities. And I just had, not too long ago, a Schnauzer in that had a very similar type thing going on. And it started within, like, you know, very shortly after the dog had been vaccinated. So it made us think, did we have some type of an immune-mediated disease that was triggered by being vaccinated? I'm not saying that don't get your pets vaccinated, but it was just one of those things where it was like, And I had our dermatologist look at it, and they agreed that that's probably, it's a chronic vasculitis type problem. You can get the ear margin biopsied if that's something that you want to do. Obviously, it would deform the ear a little bit because of the way you have to, you know, take a little piece of it off. Their recommendation for dealing with cases of vasculitis were just, you know, being really gentle. Don't pick at it, you know, kind of leave it alone. And just, you know, maybe adding a little kind of a moisture lotion or something, even a little Vaseline around the edges, and just kind of, you know, just let it be. But be on the lookout for things that may have triggered it. And that's the problem, is because usually this has been going on for a while and you're thinking back months before, well, what triggered it? It just really no treatment for it except trying to prevent it from getting worse and happening again if it is linked to something that we know, like vaccines or drug reactions and things like that, that can potentially cause an immune response like this.
It seems like one ear heals up and then the other one starts, and then that one will heal up and the other one. It's kind of been going back and forth for the last 6 months.
Yeah, and just trying to keep it, you know, not picking at it, not bothering with it, because sometimes we cause more harm. And I know that's what the owner of the dog that I was dealing with was doing. And as soon as they stopped leaving it alone, they, you know, left it alone, things started to heal a little bit better.
Okay, yeah, he yipes when I get near it. So.
Yes, okay,
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jeff in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the show. I have a Bichon Frise. He's purebred. He's going to be 4 in January. And he's just been having all sorts of allergy issues. He's been tested for Cushing's disease. He's had steroids in the past, and I really am not much of a believer in the steroids in terms of damage to other things potentially. But he's on Apoquel right now, and in spite of taking that, he just continually scratches. And we're kind of at wit's end, almost to the point of thinking about going to a specialist where we'd have to probably travel to Milwaukee at this point. But it's just crazy. I don't know if this is common with the you know, with the breed or something or what?
Allergies in general are very common, but we always want to make sure that there are no other underlying causes for itching. So we want to rule out external parasites. So having your dog on year-round flea control, and we really like to use the oral flea control products because one of the other parasites that can cause intense itching that Apoquil is not going to probably do much for is something like scabies. And they're hard to find. I mean, I've been a vet for almost 40 years, and I have yet to actually find a mite, but I have treated many dogs for them, and their itching got better. So I have to assume that they were there and I just couldn't find them. But using the oral flea and tick products, even though it's not on the label, we know that it's quite effective against some of these skin mites. So making sure your dog's on that, ruling out bacterial infections and yeast infections and making sure those are treated because Apoquil, again, just doesn't work well for itch caused by infection. We do see some dogs that Apoquil just does not work well on. It's one of those random things where it just doesn't work. And so another medication that you may want to talk to your veterinarian about trying is there's a injectable drug that's called Cytopoint, and it is similar in action to the way Apoquil works at actually the itch receptors, but it's an immune therapy, not a steroid. It lasts for anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks, and I think that if your veterinarian has ruled out all these other things, there's no infection, there's no parasites, then that might be something to consider trying. And whether your vet stocks it or not, that's a question to ask them. You may have to go to another clinic to be able to get it.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. You know, with this cold and conjunctivitis and everything else is affecting me, I completely forgot about our dog of the month.
I know.
So let's do that right now. We usually do it right after the news, but let's try that.
And I decided to go big this time. The Great Dane. Right?
That's big.
That is a big, not the biggest, not the tallest dog, but they are big. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that they must have some Danish ancestry, but they're actually a German breed that were originally bred for hunting boar and protecting property from poachers. But now they're, you know, well-loved family pets. They typically have a very, you know, nice temperament. There's always those outliers, but for the most part, they're noted for being a, you know, pretty easygoing dog that, although they require exercise, they're, you know, just because they're big doesn't mean that they need a ton of running or anything like that. In fact, because they're so big, you got to be really careful with exercising, especially as they're growing, because their bones and things could become, have an issue with that. But they do have their own unique health issues. And a couple of things that we get really concerned about with these big dogs is that they can get bloat, which is where the stomach fills up with air, and then sometimes it will twist. And so if you are contemplating adopting one of these gentle giants, then we'd want to make sure that you're feeding probably multiple small meals a day, not exercising after eating, and consider having a minor surgery done that's called a gastropexy, actually tacking the stomach down to help prevent them from torsing. Won't prevent them from bloating, but help them from torsing. Then, you know, making sure that you're dealing with a reputable breeder that's screening their dogs for heart disease, because they do get a heart muscle disease called cardiomyopathy. Doesn't occur until later in life, but if you start looking back at family trees and you start seeing that other dogs have died of this, that would be maybe a line that you'd want to stay away from. Because they're such large breed dogs, they are prone to hip dysplasia, which is genetic as well as environmental as being a cause, where they develop hip arthritis. About 14% of the Great Danes will have that as an issue. They get bone cancer, and they have a condition called Wobbler's disease, which is kind of a the name describes exactly what they look like. It's a malformation of the vertebra in their neck where the spinal cord becomes compressed. And these dogs, obviously, they start losing innervation to their limbs, and so they wobble when they walk and will need surgery to help correct this. Again, it's one of those things that's kind of a unique thing to the breed. We also see this in Dobermans. They get this as well. But the thing that I always had questions about, which is, and I don't have a good answer for this, is why do giant breed dogs have a short life expectancy, and yet other giant mammals like elephants
live
a long time.
Time,
and you know, whales and so on live for a long time.
How long do they normally live?
About 7 years. That's it. Yeah, that's like their average life expectancy is about 7 years. So we do see some that live into their teens, but it's uncommon. The average life expectancy is 7 years. So if anybody has an answer to that question, why do giant breed dogs age faster than small breed dogs? I'd love to know, but I don't know if anybody really does understand that.
Well, here's Jessica sent us a note. She's adopted a one-year-old rescue dog, separation anxiety issues. Yesterday it ate through a door to get out after being left home alone for 2 hours. Can't be kenneled because he injures himself trying to get out and or destroys the kennel so they aren't usable. What do you do to help this dog?
Oh, this is so sad when we've got dogs that are this this severely affected. Number one is this dog can't be left alone because they're going to hurt themselves and the environment. And it's just going to get worse rather than better. Number one, no punishment. Look into doggy daycare, pet sitters, in-house pet sitters, taking the dog with you if you can. Some workplaces do allow this if it's possible, but it is going to mean a little bit of work just trying to find somebody to be able to care for the dog. The dog probably is going to need to be on some form of medication as well. So using over-the-counter products, like some of the natural calmatives that I mentioned earlier, like Soliquin and Composure and so on, that might be helpful. But we're usually, when they're this bad, looking at putting them on oral medications that are prescriptions. We'll often start with things like Trazodone and then go into things like Fluoxetine, Prozac, or one of the tricyclic antidepressants that have anti-anxiety properties as well. The things that you need to do when you are with the dog is work on having non-emotional arrivals and departures so that you're not making a big deal about coming and going, and you just start very slowly. Maybe picking up your car keys and walking into another room while the dog is on a sit stay and having a delicious treat while they're distracted, and then come back again. So they realize you may disappear for a second or two, but you come right back, and you gradually work up to where you're actually getting ready, going out the door, coming back in again,
right away,
and gradually lengthening that period of time. This can take months to take care of. So that's why you finding a place for your dog to be able to be safe, such as doggy daycare or, day boarding. That is really the key to getting this under control.
And Gene on Facebook wants to know your opinion on radioactive iodine treatment for a cat with hyperthyroidism. How serious is the exposure to others once the cat is home for other pets or their owners?
The cats have to stay in. There's only a handful of places in the state that can do this because the fact that they are radioactive. They have to stay at the hospital until their radioactivity level drops to a level that's safe. Now, humans that go through the same thing because we use a toilet and that's where the radioactive material is, being passed out. They are usually, that's going to be much safer for cats because they're using a litter box. That does mean that we have to be careful, and that's why they stay in the hospital until they're safe enough to be able to go home. It is recommended that once they do go home, that they don't sleep on your lap, that you have them, sleeping someplace else, so that it's a little bit of a social change with what you do with your cat, but it's just for a short period of time. Radioactive iodine is very effective. Consider it if you've got a cat that's hyperthyroid.
Well, Dr. Sandy, you are going to be back the day after Christmas. You and I will be together here.
We'll probably be the only ones on campus, Larry. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back on December 26th. Sorry we didn't get to everybody. Thanks for all the great photos, though. Tomorrow we'll take a look at urban wildlife gardens and why they matter, not just for us, but for the larger community as well. And then we'll take a look at a unique archival account of the 20th century North Woods. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.